Welcome to the Legal Moves podcast. My name is Zachary Strebeck. I'm a California game lawyer and a blogger, and I'm your host for this podcast. With me today, I have three great guests from the board game industry. First, we have Andrew Tolson from Print and Play Games.
Hey guys, this is Andrew Tolson here. I am from Print and Play Games. We are a division of Ad Magic, and we print board game prototypes.
And we also have Daniel Solis. He's a game designer, runs his own game company called Smart Play Games.
Hello, I am Daniel Solis. I am a art director by day, game designer by night. I work in the tabletop industry, either in the production side or in making my own games.
Very cool. And last, we have JT Smith, the creator and one of the owners of The Game Crafter. JT, introduce yourself.
I think you just did, but yes, I'm JT Smith from The Game Crafter, and we also produce board game prototypes.
All right, awesome. So you can kind of see where the theme is going here. We're going to focus on using print-on-demand services and print-and-play games in the board game industry. So welcome to everyone, and let's just get started. So I'd like to just start and get everyone's background. I think that's interesting for listeners to sort of know where you're coming from, maybe what was your schooling or what was your previous work before getting into the board game industry or print on demand specifically. So JT, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I've been designing board games and role-playing games, card games since high school and college, just as a hobby. And then I started a little business called The Game Crafter to publish my own board games back in the early 2000s. And in my career, my day job, so to speak, I was a computer programmer, eventually running as the director of technology at a Fortune 500 company, and decided to go start my own businesses. And so I went and started a software company and did most of the web work for the US Department of State, building web apps for them. And sometime around 2008, I was looking for a card printer for a game I was working on, and I couldn't find somebody that would do a short run. It was a game that I knew was never going to sell huge amounts. I just wanted copies for my friends and I and the few people that may be interested. And I looked around, and there just wasn't anything there. So I decided to put my programming skills to work and built The Game Crafter into what it is today, which is basically a really nice front end where you can upload your artwork, pick a few components, and then about a week later you get a copy in the mail. And behind the scenes, all the software controls robots that create most of the products.
Very cool. It's a problem that a lot of developers have, I think, at least the smaller developers. So it's great to have you on.
Thanks.
Andrew, I'm curious what your background is and if it's similar or very different than JT's.
Yeah, it's somewhat the same.
Okay.
I started when I was 16, and it sort of turned into a business from a hobby. Some friends of mine got me started into board gaming and stuff, and I realized that I could download like free print and play games from online, and I was like, that's really sweet. And then I started doing that, started printing off my own copies of stuff, and I then realized it was cheaper to buy things in bulk. So my bedroom pretty much turned into like a whole production facility, and I just kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah.
So you were purchasing equipment to put inside your bedroom, or you were just storing things in there?
Both. It pretty much, I started like hiring friends and stuff, and we just started like printing off stuff from there. I started like buying used printers and doing stuff like that. Just people wanted like custom game things, and I was like, hey, I have the time. I can do stuff like this. So it started out just as like a personal hobby, and then turned into like a full-time job.
So you came at it from sort of the opposite side of things than JT. JT wanted to create his own game, whereas you were sort of taking advantage of the print and play games that were out there and wanting to be able to turn them into better looking games, right?
That's interesting. Right. I have. I still have my own designs and stuff that mm-hmm. I'll do, but primarily for me, it started out as I wanted to print other people's games.
Right. Now, okay, and so let's talk to Daniel. Daniel, tell us where you came from and what you're doing now.
I came from advertising, actually. Okay. I used to work in the advertising industry as a creative director and a graphic designer. But on the side, I was always designing games, and I gradually started working my way into having clients that worked in role playing games because they always needed someone to lay out books. And then from there, I used those connections to get at least a little bit of networking done, so I could, when I start making my own games, I can pitch to those publishers that I already knew from those existing relationships. Gradually, that built up, and I started making connections and started licensing and selling games to traditional publishers. But it takes a while, and I wanted to try to speed up that process somehow. And one of the ways that I thought would be interesting is if I released my games through print-on-demand services and had them available for sale, and then when I pitch to publishers, I can have the back record, the sales, right, as a sort of a support for that pitch.
Is that currently how you're working? Are you pitching these games that you're selling to publishers to try to get a wider distribution of them?
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, that was the initial plan, but it's changed in recent years, mainly because publishers that I had not even approached before from overseas, so Brazil and China, Japan, Poland, Germany, they've been noticing my games, and they see that there's no international distribution just because of there's no economy of scale when you work in POD. So they see an open license available, and they approach me, and we work out a deal. And now I'm licensing the games that I self-publish in the United States to traditional publishers overseas. It's an odd hybrid thing, and it's still a plan or a business plan that's kind of in flux at the moment.
Right.
But it's one that I'm really having a lot of fun exploring, and now finally I'm the initial part of that plan, actually approaching American publishers with my games, is actually starting to come to fruition, and I've just got my first license from a self-published game with an American publisher.
Congratulations.
Congrats.
Thanks.
Now, is the market for your games very large overseas? Is there something specific about your games, or is it just, I mean, why is the foreign publisher more interested in publishing your game first rather than domestic, I guess is my question.
Well, I think part of it is theme. One of the first games that got licensed was picked up in China, and it's a language neutral card game that has these very inkbrush looking paintings of koi fish that I put together in Photoshop. I think almost entirely language neutral, so that made it a very easy game to import with only minor translation work needed to be done on the rule book itself. Aside from that, I had already had production files available, and it was a very easy transition for that Chinese publisher. Since that license, I've sort of made that a design constraint of my own, that I have to keep my card decks within a certain card limit, that I have to, or at least try to keep them as language neutral as possible,
right,
and with themes that will be okay in international audiences. So for example, there are some restrictions about content and what you can publish in China. War themes are kind of sensitive in Europe and in China. Little things like that. And typically, I don't publish games with those kind of themes anyway. So I think it just kind of worked out in my favor in that regard.
That's good. From what I've seen of your games, it looks like the design constraints you're putting on yourself has resulted in some very beautiful designs. So,
oh, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank
Great
you.
Stuff. So let's shift gears a little bit. And I'd like to get into specifically how Andrew and JT's print-on-demand businesses work. JT, you talked a little bit about it, but I'd like to hear more about what the process is. And mainly, how did you start from, I have the idea to do this, to a full-fledged automatic robot printing service?
Well, it didn't start out to be a robotic kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying, at the time I had this idea, and I had no idea whether anybody would be interested in using it or not, but I figured it was relatively easy for me to set up because I do a lot of web work. So I built a very simple web front end to upload some artwork, and so you could get your printed components. And in the beginning, we only really did poker cards and a few mat sizes. We didn't have any boxes or booklets or boards or any of that kind of stuff. and it proved out, you know, I thought, you know, if I sell a couple hundred games a month by the end of the first year, then this will be a great little hobby business.
Right.
And in the first month, and I only had half a month the first month because I launched July 16th. In the first month, I sold 356 games.
Wow.
So I was like, whoa, right. This is unbelievable. And then last year, we did 86,000 games. That's 6 years later.
Wow.
So it's a lot of it's been a lot of growth. And the robots came in because of the huge amount of market. You know, all these people asking us to produce games. If we were doing everything by hand like we were in the original days, mm-hmm. Just couldn't keep up. There's no way, you know, we could do that. We'd have to have an army of people and an enormous facility. So I looked around and there simply weren't machines in an automated fashion to do what I wanted to do, because all the machines that exist are scaled around large scale production runs. So they'll have like a 12-hour setup time,
right?
To configure everything and get everything perfect. And you know, I need something with a 30-second setup time at most. So what I did was I would go find machines that would do something kind of similar and then modify them to suit my needs. And then, you know, write software to generate files, write controls, whatever, for the different different pieces of it. And so that's kind of the back end of how it works. On the front end, a user comes to the site. You can see all the pricing, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We do, I think, almost 90 different printed components. So like 13 different types of cards and another 10 types of boards and a bunch of different tiles and booklets and boxes, and all the different things that you might need. Plus, we have an array of over 800 little miniatures and pawns and dice and that sort of thing so that you can flesh out the game with the bits that you might need.
Mm-hmm.
And you download some templates, format your art to those templates, upload it to the website, and order a copy. And depends on the type of game that you're producing. It might cost, you know, like a deck of cards might be $6 or mm-hmm. $8 or whatever, depending on how many cards there are. Or you have a game like Monopoly, something about that complex might be around $25. Or if you go up to something like Catan with a bunch of tiles, that might be more like $35 or $40. So it just depends
right.
on what components are in there. Then it goes into the queue, and our people and robots can put the game together. And ultimately, the people in our shipping department ship it out to you, and you get a copy about a week after you ordered it.
How many employees do you have working there?
Production staff, there are, 12, including the management people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are also some mechanics, some customer service people, that sort of stuff. So I think in total, the company is 17 people.
Cool. One more question. So you said you printed 86,000 individual games. How many mm-hmm. different titles does that comprise? I guess what I want to know is, what is the
are
cutoff?
Are they all unique?
Well, yeah. What is the cutoff for someone to use the Game Crafter rather than going to somewhere like Panda or
right.
sort of larger scale printing?
Yeah. Okay. So in that 86,000, there's somewhere like 6,500 unique titles that were printed.
Mm-hmm.
The cutoff is kind of at the 500 mark. Anything okay. over 500, you're probably going to be able to find somebody else that can print it massively cheaper, because some of the Chinese producers, for example, and the Indian producers have a minimum quantity of around 500. Most of them are 1,000 or 1,500, but there are a couple that are at 500, especially if it's a card game kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the cutoff. If you're less than 500, that's our niche.
Okay.
Although people do actually print thousands of copies of games with us as well. So
does the scale pay off at some point? Do you, maybe not to the extent that the larger manufacturers can get the price down, but does the price come down significantly enough that it's okay to print thousands of copies?
Well, where it comes down is that we're printing it on demand, so you're not actually paying any warehousing fees.
Okay.
And you know, we ship it directly to the customer, so you don't have to have a shipping department, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So that's where people, you know, they'll print thousands. They may not print 1,000 at a time. They'll print, you know, 200 now and 200 next month and 200 the next month. But over the course of the year, they're over 1,000 copies.
Okay. Well, I mean, it definitely, you can see the advantages there. Andrew, I'm curious if you can walk us through your process and maybe contrast it, if at all, unless it's exactly the same from GameCrafter and how they work.
Oh, yeah, sure. So from the front end, our website that's probably the closest similarity there. Mm-hmm. You can pretty much go to our website, download the templates, upload your art files, and then submit them through our website. We have, you know, again, a bunch of different types of parts and pieces, and you just, you know, add your stuff to the website and then check out like that. So that's pretty much where we're most similar with the Game Crafter and how they work.
Right.
The biggest thing I would say, so our back end looks a little bit is a little bit different. We specialize on like anything. We can pretty much do anything. So like we'll offer like custom size boxes. So literally mm-hmm. any size box, any size board, any size card, any size token or piece or something like that. So we can give you, we give customers a lot more. Like, so if they're like, I really need a piece that looks exactly like this.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do something like that. So we don't have nearly the automation that something like the Game Crafter does, because we do a lot of stuff like, oh, you know, someone wants this particular type of thing.
Right.
So we don't really offer. So like for like bulk stuff like that, the Game Crafter has better prices because they are set up a lot more for automation of a lot of different types of things. But then we'll offer like, oh, you want a card that is slightly longer, slightly more this, or has a slightly different rounded corner, or, you know, what have you. So we can offer a little bit more customization in that department there.
Okay.
Our other thing is we have a 48-hour turnaround time. So pretty much once an order is placed, we'll pretty much turn it around inside of 48 hours. So that's...
Right.
I'm not sure, JT, what your turnaround time is looking at now.
I don't want to start a fight, but maybe, I don't know if maybe JT has a rebuttal.
No, he's absolutely right.
Limitations.
Sometimes our turnaround time could be 2 weeks, depending on,
okay,
you know, when it's being placed. Like right before Gen Con, there's a big.
Oh, yeah. Right. That was crazy.
So our orders were, I think it was a week and a half just before Gen Con. And at Christmas, it can be 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, something like that. Right now, I think our queue
is pretty good, though.
But it just depends. We flux, and he has the guaranteed turnaround time, and that's absolutely an advantage.
Okay. Dan, I don't want to leave Daniel out. So, Daniel, can you talk a little bit about how you use drive-through cards?
Yeah.
How does their process maybe differ from the two gentlemen that we've just heard from?
Well, I can't speak to the back end because I don't know anything what's going on behind the scenes. But as far as turnaround times, it's pretty much closer to GameCrafter.
Okay.
In that you place an order, you get your proof in about say a week and a half to 2 weeks, and then once you've flipped the switch and made that product public, then that's usually the turnaround time for any customer orders if they're in the United States. If they're outside of the United States, then those shipping times can be much, much longer depending on the location. But that's typically how it works.
Now, for your games, the customer is ordering through drive-through cards portal. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the order goes directly to them and you don't really have to. Do you have any hand in the process?
As far as fulfillment goes, no, I don't handle any of that, which is the advantage that I find working with the POD printer that I've done Kickstarter campaigns and I've done that kind of fulfillment on self-published products before way back in the day. And I've done it enough times to know that right up until the point when files go to print, is the part where I'm cool with doing it and I enjoy doing it. But everything after that, right, oh, I do not want to touch it.
It's, the pallets start arriving at your house,
yeah,
right?
No, I don't want any of that stuff anymore. So yeah, that's the appeal to me of doing POD as a farm league sort of thing leading right into traditional publishing.
Now, I guess, you know, as far as business goes, I guess the margin that you're going to make is going to be less if you're using a POD service. But do you find that it's offset by the fact that you don't have to deal with fulfillment and distribution and all that?
It depends on how you look at it. Okay. So POD, if you're selling POD, the volume is way lower, mm-hmm, but what you make, what you essentially take home as earnings per unit can be higher if you're the designer.
Okay.
So in a traditional publishing model, you'll get a royalty for each unit sold, and the terms will vary based on your contract, but typically it's going to be some small percentage, under 5% usually, based on net sales or on profits or whatever your contract says. But it's small per unit, right, but in the aggregate it builds up because the print runs are so big. And usually on top of that, you'll get an advance towards those royalties.
Right.
When you're doing POD, you essentially control the margins. There is a base cost for per unit of each item you sell. And then whatever you add on top of that as margin is essentially something you just take home. And so you have a lot more control about what you get home. But one thing I found in terms of pricing is that because shipping costs can be high, that I need to keep my products under a certain cost. So usually around $9.99 for a card game that's 54 cards, roughly. Mm-hmm. That tells me, all right, I have a certain base cost for that 54 card deck, and then I have a certain margin that I can afford to add on to as a markup for that cost before someone gets sticker shock. And they see, like, all right, if I'm buying this $10 game, and all of a sudden I have like $5 shipping, $10 shipping, $20 right shipping.
Well, there's also a perceived value to just a deck of cards or yes something like that, right? So if you start charging $20 for that, regardless of how good the game is, and you see this in the video game industry as well, if something's like a 2D platformer, people have a perceived value that's relatively low compared to something that's like a 3D Call of Duty type game where it looks like a lot of money went into it. So
right,
I can understand that people are going to be hesitant to pay more than $10, $15 for a
right. It also depends on the content. You know, if it's a card game, Daniel is absolutely right. But if it's there are niche audiences, niche industries right where it that changes dramatically. For example, tarot decks. People are primarily paying for the art, and tarot decks are a fairly novelty type thing. So, you know, what might be a $10 deck if it were a game turns into something that's $20, $30, $40 right as a retail sale.
Yeah, back in my amateur magician days, I did some tarot card tricks. And yeah, I remember going out and paying $20, $30 for tarot decks. It's just because, yeah, you're right. You're paying for, you know, you want specific art. Like I needed the death card or whatever to look a certain way. And, you know, you
I'm taking mental notes now.
Right. Moving to tarot decks. Yes. I mean, I don't doubt that you can make some pretty amazing looking ones, Daniel. Okay. So, well, and I think Daniel talked about it, but I think that's one of the big concerns for new game designers. The design or the development of the game itself isn't usually the hard part because that's something they're used to. It's the back end. It's all the printing and all the preparing the artwork and all of that stuff that is generally new to someone that's a new game developer. So it's good that these services exist to be able to sort of handle that for you, especially when you're new and you don't have a big name. Your print runs are going to be small. So this is definitely, it seems like a solution that there is a big problem out there, and this is a great solution. Do you guys agree? Obviously, you've made it your business, so you do agree.
Absolutely.
But I mean, would you say that this, especially for the first-time developer, this is the way to go?
Oh, absolutely. It's a no-brainer because I know so many people from back in the day when I started doing this mm-hmm that still have garages full of games that they paid for that they never sold because it was a niche game. They had no audience. They had, you know, no publisher, that sort of thing. So this not only is a great way to get your foot out there, but it also saves you a whole lot of money and storage space and, you know, things along those lines. And it also allows you to have a short, if you're going to do a crowdfunding campaign, for example, mm-hmm, you can do a crowdfunding campaign for 100 units of a game rather than, you know, having to raise $25,000 right. to do a 1,000-unit run or something like that.
Yep. Andrew?
Yeah. I would say that, like, especially with the whole, with Kickstarter and stuff, you can definitely, like, scale your campaign as low or as high as you want. Like, one of the things that we do, we partner with Ad Magic, and so pretty much my company will take care of anyone who, let's say, wants between, say, 1 and 500 games, and then we have our the Ad Magic people. They'll pretty much take care of anyone who wants more than that. Mm-hmm. So pretty much we can scale everything from, you know, 1 to 100,000 games, depending on how successful you are or how many games you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you explain your relationship with Ad Magic and how that all works a little bit?
Maybe people yeah, yeah. So earlier this year, Ad Magic bought out my company. Mm-hmm. So pretty much now we're just working together. And we pretty much both set a lot of business each other's way. This has allowed us to essentially both share clients that I need, 200 decks, but I need them next week. Or, right. I have someone who wants like a bunch of games, but they're fine with waiting for them or, something like that. So that's the primary thing. And then also with Ad Magic, we started a company called Breaking Games, mm-hmm. which is essentially a publishing arm as well. So essentially we've got a whole bunch of different options for designers. We can help them out with their Kickstarter. We can provide review copies. We can coordinate the actual printing run in China. We can, do just basic initial prototype sets, sort of the whole thing from start to finish.
Very cool. Wow.
Yeah. We have a similar relationship, and not nearly to that extent, obviously. He's been bought out, but mm-hmm. so they're directly integrated.
Right.
We have a similar relationship with Panda GM for board games, mm-hmm. and also Quality Playing Cards out of Florida for long-run card games. So
very cool. Now, you guys both started as small shops. A, when you started off, did you even imagine that you'd be bought out or partnering with these bigger firms, or were you actively seeking a partnership like that? Sorry, Andrew. Let's talk with Andrew first.
I was not. It sort of grew to the point where I was like, I knew I needed something more, but I wasn't quite sure where I wanted to go with it. Mm-hmm. It just kept on getting bigger, and I kept on needing to buy more office space. And I was like, it would be really nice to have, to have some other assets or some other people involved with it. But I just didn't have the time to research those options. Mm-hmm. And then Sherry from Ad Magic, we had been working with them for about a year. They had been passing on some clients to me. I had been passing some people back to them. And she was just like, hey, what if we just, basically partnered up? And I was like, that sounds sweet. And then it took another 6 months for us to get all the legal paperwork and to sort of finalize what mm-hmm. all that actually looked like. But it's working out great now. We've pretty much been able to expand a lot faster than we would have before.
Great. JT?
Yeah, we weren't looking for partners at all. It was when we first started. I hired a single employee that was working part-time and just, we're dealing with the orders that were coming in. It wasn't until the last couple of years where some of the Kickstarters that we've been dealing with, somebody would order 2,000 units of a game from us, and we knew there was a better way to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So we started reaching out to other firms to help us out on those larger runs so that our customers could make more profit. And then we'd still do the fulfillment for it.
Okay.
So that sort of thing.
Okay. Daniel, let's get back to you. So I don't want to leave you out. You're sort of the wild card here. But when you're designing your games, during the design process, do you take any specific considerations when you're designing due to the fact that you are releasing these as print on demand? I know you had mentioned being sort of a language neutral.
Mm-hmm.
But do you just try to stick to just a card deck or the things that are able to be pre-made?
Well, initially, I have a motorcycle going right now. Okay, sorry. So initially, what pulled me to drive-through cards was that. Sorry,
I just muted myself because there was a train going by, so it's fine. We're okay.
All right,
please go on.
What initially drew me to drive-through cards was I liked the card quality. I liked the card stock they were using, and it's only improved. It didn't bother me that they didn't have any other components available for sale. They don't do cubes, they don't do boxes, they don't do boards, or even rule books. That didn't bother me so much. I just thought if I can make a card game and it has really excellent card stock, then I can promote that and I can build that up. And at the very least, I'll have a very nice prototype to show to traditional publishers when I'm pitching to them. Right. That was still my business model at the time. That was my plan. If a customer buys these games, then they'll at least have a nice looking set of cards, but they won't have a box. And that's just going to be, that's the breaks with that particular service. And so I was okay with that. And that from that decision led me to really focus exclusively on games that could be played with only a deck of custom cards with no other elements. I've tried to use cards as other physical components sometimes, forcing, like asking the player to fold, two or three cards to act as tokens or little table tents. But aside from those little odd little efforts, I've really tried to keep cards and let cards be cards. And towards that end, I've really explored the physicality of cards and trying to do interesting things beyond just like a typical, poker style card game or what have you.
Right.
And that's where you get tile lane games like Light Rail or Kiki, which is probably my biggest seller.
Very cool. Yeah, there's something about cards. I'll harken back to my magician days. I used to do almost exclusively card magic, and there's something about cards that, I don't know, people seem to be very comfortable with. So, and one of the things that I often will tell people who are talking about doing their first game is, but with the goal of creating a company, a sustainable game company, even a small one, is to start off with something simple like a card game, right? Something that you can do easily and print easily and actually maybe make some money off of. You need to build your credentials as a developer, right? And I'm sure you have the same opinion, Daniel.
Oh yeah, totally. Whenever a new designer comes to me and they have a game, usually they're very enthusiastic. They're very excited. They really want to show it. They've been working on it for years and it's enormous.
So my
advice to them is always, just, okay, that's cool. You have your baby, but, make a second game and make it smaller.
and
work on that. Try developing that. And then you can come back to your big giant game once you've made all the mistakes with the smaller game that you're going to make, because you don't want to make those mistakes with something that you really set your heart on. Work on a small game.
I see that
frequently with card games too, though. There, people will come to us and they'll have 600 cards in
right,
their game.
Right.
I'm like,
they're missing the point. Andrew, do you have?
Yeah, I really like your Daniel, you were saying that you like put restraints on yourself. I think that for, let's say, design contests and just when you're just working on a game, actually putting on, like actually giving yourself like restrictions like that is really a great way to do it, because then you're forced to think outside the box or you're forced to think inside the box that you put yourself in, right? You're like, oh, I can only have this many things. Is if you can just add on tokens and cards and bits and boards and everything, then it just gets to be this long, complex game that usually doesn't work. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I had a similar conversation with Brian Hank from Overworld Games about Good Cop, Bad Cop, their first game. And it's similar. I think their first printing was just cards. And that's, yeah, we were talking about how that constraint on your design can really help you be more creative, because you don't have the feature creep that other types of big, token-based games might give you. So, yes, definitely good. So another sort of facet of this is the print and play games, where someone releases their game as a PDF and it's printable, and you guys, both JT and Andrew, can take those and create a physical game out of them. One of the techniques that a lot of Kickstarter and other developers are using is to give that that print and play version out either for free to or to backers. Do you think this is a smart idea? Let's go with JT.
I don't think it's a dumb idea. It's whether or not it has any merit often depends on the type of game it is. Like a tile laying game, a print and play is much harder to deal with because you know trying to create tiles at your house is a more difficult challenge than mocking up some cards.
Okay.
So it depends on the print and play. I certainly don't think it hurts you to put out a print and play either for free or as a backer level. But whether or not it helps you, that will depend.
Okay. Andrew?
Do you have an opinion? It's definitely, like, I notice almost every Kickstarter now has a print and play option. Like, almost, like, all the smaller ones, like, they automatically have that. And if they don't have a print and play option, like, people will say, oh, you know, where's the print and play set? I think that even if you don't, like, even if the people don't print it out, letting people be able to see the card art and like and see how the game works is really a cool idea. And even if they don't print it out, at least they've downloaded it, at least they've looked at it, and if you have a good presentation there, then I think it can really help. I think it also helps with the fact that if someone does print out the set and then they take it to say a game store and like, hey, look at this cool game.
Right.
And it was like, oh, where can I get it? Oh, wait, only Kickstarter, which is going on, you know, which is finishing in the next 2 days. It really, I think it's really a great opportunity for, I mean, it's almost free advertising. It's like other people do all the work for you. And there are some downsides to it, like the fact that, you know, people sort of have an expectation for your game, or if someone sees a print and play copy, they could be, you know, they could be confused. Or things like that, but
it may not be the quality that you would want when you release it. Something like that, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like if they see a print and play copy out in the wild, and then someone sees it and they're like, "Oh yeah, you know, I saw this game, but it didn't look very professional."
Right.
Something like
some
that.
Guy printed it on his home computer. Right.
Exactly, yeah. And that's exactly what happened. Right. But you know, it's not really the perception that you want.
Right.
So I think that for the most part, the pros outweigh the cons in this case.
Daniel, have you used this technique when you've done your Kickstarters?
When I actually do playtesting, I'll release a print and play as a public document. Lately, I've kind of taken to a slightly more private type of playtesting, mainly because when I release a print and play PDF, a lot of times I'll get people who say they'll playtest, but you know, the response rate's usually about 10%.
Right.
So the more high contact I can get with people who say they're going to playtest, the more I can pester them and remind them, hey, remember that thing I sent you about 2 weeks ago? You got any feedback on that? Maybe.
Well, that makes sense.
So usually I do it more for development than for any kind of promotional thing. But I mean, if it is out there in the wild, just floating out there. I'm not worried about it so much, mainly because of the quality issues that you mentioned. That, you know, anything that someone can print at home is not going to be the same quality as you'll get from a good POD service or like any of the ones we've been talking about today.
Right. Now, what about let's say you're relying on the Kickstarter funds to pay your artist to create the art for the game. So you want to release a print and play playtest version or as a Kickstarter reward, but you don't have the final artwork. Are there any solutions there? I mean, I guess you could use the gameicons.net type of things or some public domain images, but what would you recommend in those situations, Daniel?
I would recommend going through any public domain archives you can find to find any art that is clearly public domain, but you're not implying that this is going to be the final art,
right,
but it still is enough to be evocative for actual gameplay purposes.
Okay.
And there's tons and tons of public domain art you can find: photography, historical images, and that kind of thing. And then you can supplement that with the with Creative Commons really licensed icons from GameIcons.net or from the Noun Project. That has a lot of really good ones. And I have my own icon sets that I release on Patreon. So you can use any of those as well.
Very cool.
And yeah, so those are the solutions I would recommend if you can't afford to get any professional artists yet. But one of the tricky things about Kickstarter lately is that they kind of do expect you to have all the art done already.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sad, but true.
It sucks, and that's kind of what led me to be less focused on crowdfunding more recently.
Okay. Well, I mean, it just sort of puts the pressure on the developer to partner up with an artist or to, you know, in some cases I've had people, clients, raise money beforehand before, you know, so that they can, maybe from friends and family, you get loans and things like that. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to raise that a few thousand dollars to pay an artist to create a bunch of great art. It's possible. Not everyone's going to be able to do it, but, you know, if you're serious about it and you believe in your product, sometimes it's worth the risk. I mean, you can't put all the risk on the Kickstarter backers. Sometimes you have to, if you believe in your business, you have to put it on yourself. But then again, you're doing it with other people's money anyway, because you're taking loans from family. So that's, and I always say that's the best way to do it, is to use other people's money to create your product, whether it's Kickstarter or it's family or you know, regular investors. It's the way you should do it. So this is the end of part one. We're going to pick this up in the next episode. But in the meantime, I'd like to know where our listeners can find you. Daniel.
You can find me on Twitter, where I tweet too much, at Daniel Solis. That's DanielSolis. You can also find my blog at danielsolis.com. And you can find my games at smartplaygames.com, which takes you directly to my publisher page on drivethroughcards.com.
Very cool. Andrew, where can we find you?
You can find us on the web at printplaygames.com, also addmagic.com. And on both of those pages are links to our Facebook pages where we post cool pictures and fun stuff like that.
Very cool. And JT?
You can find The Game Crafter at thegamecrafter.com or The Game Crafter on both Facebook and Twitter. And me personally at Plain Black Guy on Twitter and Tumblr.
Awesome. Well, you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com, and I just created a contract creation website for board gamers and video game developers at indiegenerator.com. So I have a coupon code. It's indiegen50off, and you can get 50% off of any contracts you make for the rest of the year. Also, nice. Make sure to review us on iTunes, because those reviews really help, and currently I have zero. So even one would be amazing. So if you enjoyed this episode, please review us on iTunes. So I'll see you next week with the second part of this conversation with Andrew, JT, and Daniel.